expect to be on the ground between 2 and 3 hours. We will stay together at all times. If any of us is separated from the others, use your earpieces to get together again. We will find the professor and go right back. Okay? Got it. You'll have 2 escorts, myself and Victor Barreto, over there in the corner. Say hello, Vic. The second escort was a surly man who looked like an ex-marine, a tough and able man. Barreto's period clothes were more peasant-like, loose-fitting, made of a fabric like burlap. He gave a nod and a slight wave. He seemed to be in a bad mood. Okay, Gomez said. Other questions? Chris said, Professor Johnston has been there 3 days? That's right. Who do the locals think he is? We don't know, Gomez said. We don't know why he left the machine in the first place. He must have had a reason. But since he is in the world, the simplest thing for him would be to pose as a clerk or scholar from London on a pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela in Spain. Saint-Mer is on the pilgrimage route, and it is not unusual for pilgrims to break their trip to stay a day or a week, especially if they strike up a friendship with the abbot, who is quite a character. The professor may have done that, or he may not. We just don't know. But wait a minute, Chris Hughes said. Won't his presence there change the local history? Won't he influence the outcome of events? No, he won't. How do you know? Because he can't. But what about the time paradoxes? Time paradoxes? That's right, Stern said. You know, like going back in time and killing your grandfather so that you can't be born and couldn't go back and kill your grandfather? Oh, that. She shook her head impatiently. There are no time paradoxes. What do you mean? Of course there are. No, there aren't, came a firm voice behind them. They turned. Doniger was there. Time paradoxes do not occur. What do you mean? Stern said. He was feeling put out that his question had been so roughly treated. The so-called time paradoxes, Doniger said, do not really involve time. They involve ideas about history that are seductive but wrong. Seductive because they flatter you into thinking you can have an impact on the course of events, and wrong because, of course, you can't. You can't have an impact on events? No. Of course you can. No, you can't. It's easier to see if you take a contemporary example. Say you go to a baseball game, the Yankees and the Mets. The Yankees are going to win, obviously. You want to change the outcome so that the Mets win. What can you do? You're just one person in a crowd. If you try to go to the dugout, you'll be stopped. If you try to go onto the field, you will be hauled away. Most ordinary actions available to you will end in failure and will not alter the outcome of the game. Let's say you choose a more extreme action. You'll shoot the Yankee pitcher. But the minute you pull a gun, you are likely to be overpowered by nearby fans. Even if you get off a shot, you'll almost certainly miss. And even if you succeed in hitting the pitcher, what is the result? Another pitcher will take his place, and the Yankees will win the game. Let's say you choose an even more extreme action. You will release a nerve gas and kill everyone in the stadium. Once again, you're unlikely to succeed for all the reasons you're unlikely to get a shot off. But even if you do manage to kill everybody, you still have not changed the outcome of the game. You may argue that you have pushed history in another direction, and perhaps so, but you haven't enabled the Mets to win the game. In reality, there is nothing you can do to make the Mets win. You remain what you always were, a spectator. And this same principle applies to the great majority of historical circumstances. A single person can do little to alter events in any meaningful way. Of course, great masses of people can change the course of history, but one person, no. Maybe so, Stern said, but I can kill my grandfather. And if he's dead, then I couldn't be born, so I would not exist, and therefore I couldn't have shot him, and that's a paradox. Yes, it is, assuming you actually kill your grandfather. But that may prove difficult in practice. So many things go wrong in life. You may not meet up with him at the right time. You may be hit by a bus on your way, or you may fall in love. You may be arrested by the police. You may kill him too late, after your parent has already been conceived, or you may come face to face with him and find you can't pull the trigger. But in theory, when we are dealing with history, theories are worthless, Doniger said with a contemptuous wave. A theory is only valuable if it has the ability to predict future outcomes. But history is the record of human action, and no theory can predict human action. He rubbed his hands together. Now then, shall we end all this speculation and be on our way? There were murmurs from the others. Stern cleared his throat. Actually, he said, I don't think I'm going. Merrick had been expecting it. He'd watched Stern during the briefing, noticing the way he kept shifting in his chair, as if he couldn't get comfortable. Stern's anxiety had been steadily growing ever since the tour began. Merrick himself had no doubts about going. Since his youth, he had lived and breathed the medieval world, imagining himself in Warburg and Carcassonne, Avignon and Milan. He had joined the Welsh Wars with Edward I. He had seen the burghers of Calais give up their city, and he attended the Champagne Fairs. He had lived at the splendid courts of Eleanor of Aquitaine and the Duc de Berry. Merrick was going to take this trip, no matter what. As for Stern, I'm sorry, Stern was saying, but this isn't my affair. I only signed on to the professor's team because my girlfriend was going to summer school in Toulouse. I am not a historian, I'm a scientist, and anyway, I don't think it's safe. Doniger said, you don't think the machines are safe? No, the place. The year, 1357. There was a civil war in France after Poitiers. Free companies of soldiers pillaging the countryside. Bandits, cutthroats, lawlessness everywhere. Merrick nodded. If anything, Stern was understating the situation. The 14th century was a vanished world and a dangerous one. It was a religious world. Most people went to church at least once a day. But it was an incredibly violent world, where invading armies killed everyone, where women and children were routinely hacked to death, where pregnant women were eviscerated for sport. It was a world that gave lip service to the ideas of chivalry while indiscriminately pillaging and murdering, where women were imagined to be powerless and delicate, yet they ruled fortunes, commanded castles, took lovers at will, and plotted assassination and rebellion. It was a world of shifting boundaries and shifting allegiances, often changing from one day to the next. It was a world of death, of sweeping plagues, of disease, of constant warfare. Gordon said to Stern, I certainly wouldn't want to force you. But remember, Doniger said, you won't be alone. We'll be sending escorts with you. I'm sorry, Stern kept saying, I'm sorry. Finally, Merrick said, let him stay, he's right. It's not his period, and it's not his affair. Now that you mention it, Chris said, I've been thinking, it's not my period either. I'm much more late 13th than true 14th century. Maybe I should stay with David. Forget it, Merrick said, throwing an arm over Chris's shoulder. You'll be fine. Merrick treated it like a joke, even though he knew Chris wasn't exactly joking. Not exactly. The room was cold. Chilly mist covered their feet and ankles. They left ripples in the mist as they walked toward the machines. Four cages had been linked together at the bases, and a fifth cage stood by itself. Barreto said, that's mine, and stepped into the single cage. He stood erect, staring forward, waiting. Susan Gomez stepped into one of the clustered cages and said, the rest of you come with me. Merrick, Kate, and Chris climbed into the cages next to her. The machine seemed to be on springs. They rocked slightly as each got in. Everybody all set? The others murmured, nodded. Barreto said, ladies first. You got that right, she said. There didn't seem to be any love lost between them. Okay, she said to the others. We're off. Chris's heart began to pound. He felt lightheaded and panicky. He balled his hands into fists. Gomez said, relax. I think you'll find it's quite enjoyable. She slipped the ceramic into the slot at her feet and stood back up. Here we go. Remember, everyone very still when the time comes. The machines began to hum. Chris felt a slight vibration in the base beneath his feet. The humming of the machines grew louder. The mist swirled away from the bases of the machines. The machines began to creak and squeal, as if metal was being twisted. The sound built quickly until it was as steady and as loud as a scream. That's from the liquid helium, Gomez said, chilling the metal to superconduction temperatures. Abruptly, the screaming ended, and the chattering sound began. Infrared clearance, she said. This is it. Chris felt his whole body begin to tremble involuntarily. He tried to control it, but his legs were shaking. He had a moment of panic. Maybe he should call it off, but then he heard a recorded voice say, stand still, eyes open. Too late, he thought. Too late. Deep breath. Hold it. Now, the circular ring descended from above his head, moving swiftly to his feet. It clicked as it touched the base. And a moment later there was a blinding flash of light, brighter than the sun, coming from all around him. But he felt nothing at all. In fact, he had a sudden strange sense of cold detachment, as if he were now observing a distant scene. The world around him was completely, utterly silent. He saw Barreto's nearby machine was growing larger, starting to loom over him. Barreto, a giant, his huge face with monstrous pores, was bending over, looking down at them. More flashes. As Barreto's machine grew larger, it also appeared to move away from them, revealing a widening expanse of floor, a vast plain of dark rubber floor stretching away into the distance. More flashes. The rubber floor had a pattern of raised circles. Now these circles began to rise up around them like black cliffs. Soon the black cliffs had grown so high that they now seemed like black skyscrapers, joining overhead, closing off the light above. Finally, the skyscrapers touched one another, and the world was dark. More flashes. They sank into inky blackness for a moment before he distinguished flickering pinpoints of light, arranged in a grid-like pattern, stretching away in all directions. It was as if they were inside some enormous, glowing, crystalline structure. As Chris watched, the points of light grew brighter and larger, their edges blurring, until each became a fuzzy, glowing ball. He wondered if these were atoms. He could no longer see the grid, just a few nearby balls. His cage moved directly toward one glowing ball, which appeared to be pulsing, changing its shape in flickering patterns. Then they were inside the ball, immersed in a bright glowing fog that seemed to throb with energy. And then the glow faded and was gone. They hung in featureless blackness. Nothing. Blackness. But then he saw they were still sinking downward, now heading toward the churning surface of a black ocean in a black night. The ocean whipped and boiled, making a frothy blue-tinged foam. As they descended to the surface, the foam grew larger. Chris saw that one bubble in particular had a particularly bright blue glow. His machine moved toward that glow at accelerating speed, flying faster and faster, and he had the odd sensation that they were going to crash in the foam. And then they entered the bubble, and he heard a loud, piercing shriek. Then silence. Darkness. Nothing. In the control room, David Stern watched the flashes on the rubber floor become smaller and weaker and finally vanish entirely. The machines were gone. The technicians immediately turned to Barreto and began his transmission countdown. But Stern kept staring at the spot in the rubber floor where Chris and the others had been. "And where are they now?" he asked Gordon. "Oh, they've arrived now," Gordon said. "They are there now."
"They've been rebuilt?"
"Yes."
"Without a fax machine at the other end?"
"That's right."
"Tell me why," Stern said. "Tell me the details the others didn't need to be bothered with."
"All right," Gordon said. "It isn't anything bad. I just thought the others might find it, well, disturbing."
"Uh-huh."
"Let's go back," Gordon said, "to the interference patterns, which you remember showed us that other universes can affect our own universe. We don't have to do anything to get the interference pattern to occur. It just happens by itself."
"Yes."
"And this interaction is very reliable. It will always occur whenever you set up a pair of slits."
Stern nodded. He was trying to see where this was going, but he couldn't foresee the direction Gordon was taking.
"So we know that in certain situations, we can count on other universes to make something happen. We hold up the slits, and the other universes make the pattern we see every time."
"Okay."
"And if we transmit through a wormhole, the person is always reconstituted at the other end. We can count on that happening, too."
There was a pause. Stern frowned. "Wait a minute," he said. "Are you saying that when you transmit, the person is being reconstituted by another universe?"
"In effect, yes. I mean, it has to be. We can't very well reconstitute them, because we're not there. We're in this universe."
"So you're not reconstituting?"
"No."
"Because you don't know how," Stern said.
"Because we don't find it necessary," Gordon said. just as we don't find it necessary to glue plates to a table to make them stay put. They stay by themselves. We make use of a characteristic of the universe, gravity. And in this case, we are making use of a characteristic of the multiverse. Stern frowned. He immediately distrusted the analogy. It was too glib, too easy. Look, Gordon said, the whole point of quantum technology is that it overlaps universes. When a quantum computer calculates, when all 32 quantum states of the electron are being used, the computer is technically carrying out those calculations in other universes, right? Yes, technically, but no, not technically, really. There was a pause. It may be easier to understand, Gordon said, by seeing it from the point of view of the other universe. That universe sees a person suddenly arrive, a person from another universe. Yes, and that's what happened. The person has come from another universe, just not ours. Say again? The person didn't come from our universe, Gordon said. Stern blinked. Then where? They came from a universe that is almost identical to ours, identical in every respect, except that they know how to reconstitute it at the other end.
You're joking.
No.
The Kate who lands there isn't the Kate who left here? She's a Kate from another universe?
Yes.
So she's almost Kate? Sort of Kate? Semi-Kate?
No, she's Kate. As far as we have been able to tell with our testing, she is absolutely identical to our Kate, because our universe and their universe are almost identical.
But she's still not the Kate who left here.
How could she be? She's been destroyed and reconstructed.
Do you feel any different when this happens? Stern said.
Only for a second or two, Gordon said.
Blackness. Silence. And then, in the distance, glaring white light. Coming closer. Fast. Chris shivered as a strong electric shock rippled through his body and made his fingers twitch. For a moment, he suddenly felt his body, the way one feels clothes when you first put them on. He felt the encompassing flesh, felt the weight of it, the pull of gravity downward, the pressure of his body on the soles of his feet. Then a blinding headache, a single pulse, and then it was gone, and he was surrounded by intense purple light. He winced and blinked his eyes. He was standing in sunlight. The air was cool and damp. Birds chirruped in the huge trees rising above him. Shafts of sunlight came down through the thick foliage, dappling the ground. He was standing in one beam. The machine stood beside a narrow, muddy path that wound through a forest. Directly ahead, through a gap in the trees, he saw a medieval village. First, a cluster of farm plots and huts, plumes of gray smoke rising from thatched roofs, then a stone wall, and the dark stone roofs of the town itself inside, and finally, in the distance, the castle with circular turrets. He recognized it at once, the town and the fortress of Castelgar, and it was no longer a ruin. Its walls were complete. He was here.
Castelgar. Nothing in the world is as certain as death. Jean Froissart, 1359. 37 hours, 0 minutes, 0 seconds. Gomez hopped lightly out of the machine. Merrick and Kate stepped slowly out of their cages, seemingly dazed as they looked around. Chris climbed out, too. His foot touched the mossy ground. It was springy underfoot. Merrick said, "Fantastic!" and immediately moved away from the machine, crossing the muddy path for a better look at the town. Kate followed behind him. She still seemed to be in shock. But Chris wanted to stay close to the machine. He turned slowly, looking at the forest. It struck him as dark, dense, primeval. The trees, he noticed, were huge. Some of them had trunks so thick you could hide 3 or 4 people behind them. They rose high into the sky, spreading a leafy canopy above them that darkened most of the ground below.
"Beautiful, isn't it?" Gomez said. She seemed to sense that he was uneasy.
"Yes, beautiful," he answered. But he didn't feel that way at all.
Something about this forest struck him as sinister. He turned round and round, trying to understand why he had the distinct feeling that something was wrong with what he was seeing. Something was missing or out of place. Finally he said, "What's wrong?"
She laughed. "Oh, that," she said. "Listen."
Chris stood silently for a moment, listening. There was the chirp of birds, the soft rustle of a faint breeze in the trees, but other than that, I don't hear anything.
"That's right," Gomez said. "It upsets some people when they first arrive. There's no ambient noise here, no radio or TV, no airplanes, no machinery, no passing cars. In the 20th century, we're so accustomed to hearing sound all the time, the silence feels creepy."
I guess that's right. At least, that was exactly how he was feeling.
He turned away from the trees and looked at the muddy path, a sunlit track through the forest. In many places, the mud was 2 feet deep, churned by many hoofprints. This was a world of horses, he thought. No machine sounds, lots of hoofprints. He took a deep breath and let it out slowly. Even the air seemed different, heady, bright feeling, as if it had more oxygen in it. He turned and saw that the machine was gone. Gomez appeared unconcerned.
"Where's the machine?" he said, trying not to sound worried.
"It drifted."
"It drifted?"
"When the machines are fully charged, they're a little unstable. They tend to slide off the present moment, so we can't see them."
"Where are they?" Chris said.
She shrugged. "We don't know exactly. They must be in another universe. Wherever they are, they're fine. They always come back." To demonstrate, she held up her ceramic marker and pressed the button with her thumbnail. In increasingly bright flashes of light, the machine returned, all 4 cages, standing exactly where they had been a few minutes before.
"Now it'll stay here like this for maybe a minute, maybe 2, Gomez said, "but eventually it will drift again. I just let them go. Gets them out of the way."
Chris nodded. She seemed to know what she was talking about. But the thought that the machines drifted made Chris vaguely uneasy. Those machines were his ticket back home, and he didn't like to think that they behaved according to their own rules and could disappear at random. He thought, would anybody fly on an airplane if the pilot said that it was unstable? He felt a coolness on his forehead, and he knew in a moment he would break out in a cold sweat. To distract himself, Chris picked his way across the path, following the others, trying not to sink into the mud. On solid ground again, he pushed through thick ground cover, some kind of dense, waist-high plant like rhododendron. He glanced back at Gomez. "Anything to worry about in these woods?"
"Just vipers," she said. "They're usually in the lower branches of the trees. They fall down on your shoulders and bite you."
"Great," he said.
"Are they poisonous?"
"Very."
"Fatal?"
"Don't worry. They're very rare," she said.
Chris decided not to ask any more questions. Anyway, by now he had reached a sunlit opening in the foliage. He looked down and saw the Dordogne River 200 feet below him, twisting through farmland and looking, he thought, not very different from the way he was used to seeing it. But if the river was the same, everything else in this landscape was different. Castelgar was entirely intact, and so was its town. Beyond the walls were farming plots. Some of the fields were being plowed now. But his attention was drawn to the right, where he looked down on the great rectangular complex of the monastery and the fortified mill bridge. His fortified bridge, he thought. The bridge he had been studying all summer. And unfortunately, looking very different from the way he had reconstructed it in the computer. Chris saw 4 water wheels, not 3, churning in the current that ran beneath the bridge. And the bridge above was not a single unified structure. There seemed to be at least 2 independent structures, like little houses. One was made of stone and the other of wood, suggesting the structures had been built at different times. From the larger stone building, smoke belched in a continuous gray plume. So maybe they really were making steel there, he thought.
If you had water-powered bellows, then you could have an actual blast furnace. That would explain the separate structures, too, because mills that ground grain or corn never permitted any open fire or flame inside, not even a candle. That was why grinding mills operated only during daylight hours. Absorbed in the details, he felt himself relax. On the far side of the muddy path, Merrick stared at the village of Kestelgar with a slow sense of astonishment. He was here. He felt lightheaded, almost giddy with excitement, as he took in the details. In the fields below, peasants wore patched leggings and tunics in red and blue, orange and rose. The vivid colors stood out against the dark earth. Most of the fields were already planted, their furrows closed over. This was early April, so the spring planting of barley, peas, oats, and beans, the so-called Lenten crops, would be nearly finished. He watched a new field being plowed, the black iron blade hauled by two oxen. The plow itself turned the earth of the furrow neatly on both sides. He was pleased to see a low wooden guard mounted above the blade. That was a mold board, and it was characteristic of this particular time. Walking behind the plowman, a peasant sowed seed with rhythmic sweeps of his arm. The sack of seed hung from his shoulder. A short distance behind the sower, birds fluttered down to the furrow eating the seed, but not for long. In a nearby field, Merrick saw the harrower, a man riding a horse that dragged a wooden T-frame weighted down by a large rock. The harrower closed the furrows, protecting the seed. Everything appeared to move in the same gentle, steady rhythm. The hand throwing seed, the plow turning the furrow, the harrow scraping the ground. And there was almost no sound in the still morning, just the hum of insects and the twitter of birds. Beyond the fields, Merrick saw the 20-foot-high stone wall encircling the town of Kestelgar. The stone was a dark, weathered gray. In one section, the wall was being repaired. The new stone was lighter in color, yellow-gray. Masons were hunched over, working quickly. Atop the wall itself, guards in chainmail strode back and forth, sometimes pausing to stare nervously into the distance. And rising above everything, the castle itself, with its circular towers and black stone roofs. Flags fluttered from the turrets. All the flags showed the same emblem, a maroon and gray shield with a silver rose. It gave the castle a festive appearance, and indeed, in a field just outside the town walls, a large wooden viewing stand, like bleachers, was being erected for the tournament. A crowd had already begun to gather. A few knights were there, horses tied beside the brightly colored striped tents that were pitched all around the tournament field itself. Pages and grooms threaded their way among the tents, carrying armor and water for the horses. Merrick took it all in and gave a long, satisfied sigh. Everything he saw was accurate, down to the smallest detail. Everything was real. He was here. Kate Erickson stared at Kestelgar with a sense of puzzlement. Beside her, Merrick was sighing like a lover, but she wasn't sure why. Of course, Kestelgar was now a lively village, restored to its former glory, its houses and castle complete. But overall, the scene before her didn't look that different from any rural French landscape, perhaps a little more backward than most, with horses and oxen instead of tractors. But otherwise, well, it just wasn't that different. Architecturally, the biggest difference she saw in the scene before her and the present was that all the houses had Lowe's roofs made of stacked black stone. These stone roofs were incredibly heavy and required a great deal of internal bracing, which was why houses in the Périgord no longer used them, except in tourist areas. She was accustomed to seeing French houses with ochre roofs of curved Roman tile, or the flat tile of the French style. Yet here, Lowe's roofs were everywhere. There was no tile at all. As she continued to look at the scene, she slowly noticed other details. For example, there were a lot of horses, really a lot, when you considered the horses in the field, the horses at the tournament, the horses ridden on the dirt roads, and the horses put out to pasture. There must be 100 horses in her view right now, she thought. She couldn't remember seeing so many horses at one time, even in her native Colorado. All kinds of horses, from beautiful, sleek war horses at the tournament to barnyard nags in the fields. And while many of the people working in the fields were drably dressed, others wore colors so brilliant they almost reminded her of the Caribbean. These clothes were patched and patched again, but always in a contrasting color, so that the patchwork was visible even from a distance. It became a kind of design. Then, too, she became aware of a clear demarcation between the relatively small areas of human habitation, towns and fields, and the surrounding forest, a dense, vast green carpet stretching away in all directions. In this landscape, the forest predominated. She had the sense of encompassing wilderness, in which human beings were interlopers, and minor interlopers at that. And as she looked again at the town of Castelgaur itself, she sensed there was something odd that she couldn't put her finger on, until she finally realized there were no chimneys. No chimneys anywhere. The peasant houses simply had holes in the thatched roofs from which smoke issued. Within the town, the houses were similar, even though their roofs were stone. The smoke issued from a hole or from a vent in a wall. The castle lacked chimneys, too. She was looking at a time before chimneys appeared in this part of France. For some reason, this trivial architectural detail made her shiver with a kind of horror. A world before chimneys. When had chimneys been invented, anyway? She couldn't remember exactly. Certainly by 1600 they were common, but that was a long time from now. This now, she reminded herself. Behind her, she heard Gomez say, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" Kate looked back and saw that the surly guy, Barreto, had arrived. His single cage was visible on the other side of the path, a few yards back in the woods.
"I'll do what I damn well want to do," he said to Gomez.
He had pulled up his burlap tunic, revealing a heavy leather belt with a holstered pistol and two black grenades. He was checking the pistol. "If we're going into the world," Barreto said, "I'm going to be prepared." "You're not bringing that stuff with you," Gomez said. "The hell I'm not, sister." "You're not. You know that's not allowed. Gordon would never permit modern weapons to be taken into the world." "But Gordon's not here, is he?" Barreto said. "Look, goddammit," Gomez said, and she pulled out her white ceramic marker, waving it at Barreto. It looked as if she was threatening to go back.
36 hours, 55 minutes, 22 seconds. In the control room, one of the technicians at the monitor said, "We're getting field bucks."
"Oh, really? That's good news," Gordon said.
"Why?"
Stern said. "It means," Gordon said, "that someone is headed back in the next 2 hours. Undoubtedly your friends."
"So they will get the professor and be back here within 2 hours?"
"Yes, that's exactly."
Gordon broke off, staring at the undulating image on the monitor. A little undulating surface with a spike that stuck up.
"Is that it?"
"Yes," the technician said.
"But the amplitude's much too large,"
he said. "Yes, and the interval's getting shorter, fast." "You mean someone is coming back now?"
"Yeah, right away, it looks like."
Stern glanced at his watch. The team had been gone only a couple of minutes. They couldn't have recovered the professor so quickly. "What does that mean?" Stern asked him.
"I don't know," Gordon said.
The truth was, he didn't like this development at all.
"They must be having some sort of trouble."
"What kind of trouble?"
"This soon, it's probably mechanical. Maybe a transcription error."
Stern said, "What's a transcription error?" The technician said, "I'm calculating an arrival in 2 minutes, 57 seconds. He was measuring the field strengths and the pulse intervals.
"How many are coming back?"
Gordon said.
"All of them?"
"No," the technician said. "Just one."
36 hours, 49 minutes, 19 seconds. Chris Hughes couldn't help it. He was anxious again. Despite the cool morning air, he was sweating, his skin cold, his heart pounding. Listening to Barreto and Gomez argue did nothing to increase his confidence. He went back to the path, stepping around the pools of thick mud. Merrick and Kate were coming back, too. They all stood a little apart from the argument.
All right, goddammit, Barreto was saying.
He took off his weapons and put them carefully on the floor of his cage.
All right, does that satisfy you?
Gomez was still speaking quietly, barely a whisper. Chris couldn't hear her.
It's fine, Barreto said, almost snarling.
Gomez again spoke softly. Barreto was grinding his teeth. It was very uncomfortable to be standing there. He moved a few steps farther away, turning his back to the argument, waiting for it to be over. Chris was surprised to see that the path sloped downward rather steeply, and he could see through a break in the trees to the flatland below. The monastery was there, a geometric arrangement of courtyards, covered passageways, and cloisters, all built of beige stone, surrounded by a high stone wall. It looked like a dense, compact little city. It was surprisingly close, perhaps a quarter of a mile, no more than that.
Screw it, I'm walking, Kate said, and she started down the path.
Merrick and Chris looked at each other, then followed after her.
You people stay in sight, dammit, Barreto called to them.
Gomez said, I think we'd better go. Barreto put a restraining hand on her arm.
Not until we get something cleared up, he said, about how things are handled on this expedition.
I think it's pretty well cleared up, Gomez said. Barreto leaned close and said,
because I didn't like the way you...
And the rest was too low to hear, just the furious hiss of his voice. Chris was grateful to move around the curb in the path and leave them behind. Kate started at a brisk walk, feeling the tension leave her body as she moved. The argument left her feeling cramped and edgy. A few paces behind her, she heard Chris and Merrick talking. Chris was anxious, and Merrick was trying to calm him down. She didn't want to hear it. She picked up the pace a little. After all, to be here in these fantastic woods, surrounded by these huge trees... After a minute or two, she had left Merrick and Chris behind, but she knew they were near enough and it was nice to be alone. The woods around her felt cool and relaxing. She listened to the chitter of birds and the sound of her own feet padding along the path. Once she thought she heard something else, too. She slowed a bit to listen. Yes, there was another sound, running feet. They seemed to be coming from farther down the path. She heard someone panting, gasping for breath. And also a fainter sound, like the rumble of distant thunder. She was trying to place that rumble when a teenage boy burst around the corner, racing toward her. The boy was wearing black hose, a bright green quilted jacket, and a black cap. He was red-faced with exertion. He'd clearly been running for some time. He seemed startled to find her walking on the path. As he came toward her, he cried,
"Ideth thee, Emsel! Grassa do! Ide thee!"
An instant later, she heard his voice translated in her earpiece.
"Hide, woman, for the sake of God, hide!"
Hide from what? Kate wondered. These woods were deserted. What could he mean? Maybe she hadn't understood him right. Maybe the translator wasn't correct. As the boy passed her, he again cried,
"Hide!"
and shoved Erickson hard, pushing her off the path and into the woods. She tripped on a gnarled root, tumbled into the undergrowth. She banged her head, felt sharp pain and a wave of dizziness. She was getting slowly to her feet when she realized what the rumbling sound was. Horses, riding at full gallop toward her. Chris saw the young boy running up the path, and almost immediately he heard the sound of pursuing horses. The boy, finally out of breath, stopped for a moment beside them, doubled over, and finally managed to gasp,
"Hide! Hide!"
before he darted away into the woods. Merrick ignored the boy. He was looking down the path. Chris frowned.
"What is all that about?"
"Now," Merrick said, and throwing an arm around Chris's shoulders, he pulled him bodily off the path and into the foliage beside the path.
"Jesus," Chris said. "Would you mind telling me?"
"Shh."
Merrick put his hand over Chris's mouth.
"Do you want to get us killed?"
No, Chris thought. He was clear on that. He did not want to get anybody killed. Charging up the hill toward them were six horsemen in full armor, steel helmets, chainmail, and cloth surcoats of maroon and gray. The horses were draped in black cloth studded with silver. The effect was ominous.
The lead rider, wearing a helmet with a black plume, pointed ahead and screamed, "Godin!" Barreto and Gomez were still standing beside the path, just standing there, apparently in shock at what they saw galloping toward them. The black rider leaned over in the saddle and swung his broadsword in an arc at Gomez as he rode past her. Chris saw Gomez's headless torso spurting blood as it toppled to the ground. Barreto, spattered with blood, swore loudly as he ran into the woods. More riders galloped up the hill. Now they were all shouting, "Godin! Godin!" One rider wheeled on his horse, drawing his bow. The arrow struck Barreto's left shoulder as he ran, the steel point punching through the other side, the impact knocking him to his knees. Cursing, Barreto staggered to his feet again, and finally he reached his machine. He picked up his belt, yanked one of the grenades free, and turned to throw it. An arrow struck him full in the chest. Barreto looked surprised, coughed, and fell back, sprawled in a seated position against the bars. He made a feeble effort to pull the arrow out of his chest. The next arrow passed through his throat. The grenade dropped from his hands. Back on the path, the horses reared and whinnied, their riders wheeling in circles, shouting and pointing. There was a bright flash of light. Chris looked back, in time to see Barreto still seated, unmoving, as the machine flashed repeatedly, shrinking in size. In moments, the machine was gone. The riders now had looks of fear on their faces. The black-plumed rider shouted something to the others, and as a group, they whipped their horses and raced on up the hill, out of sight. As the black rider turned to go, his horse stumbled over Gomez's body. Cursing, the rider wheeled and reared his horse repeatedly, stomping the body again and again. Blood flew in the air. The horse's forelegs turned dark red. At last, the black rider turned, and with a final curse, he galloped up the hill again to rejoin the others. Jesus. The suddenness of it. The casual violence. Chris scrambled to his feet, ran back to the path. Gomez's body lay in a muddy pool, crushed almost beyond recognition. But one hand was flung outward and lay open on the ground. And next to her hand lay the white ceramic marker. It was cracked open. Its electronic innards exposed. Chris picked it up. The ceramic fell apart in his hands, bits of white and silver fluttering to the ground, falling into the muddy pool. And in that moment, their situation was clear to him. Their guides were both dead. One machine was gone. Their return marker was shattered, which meant they were stuck in this place, trapped here, without guides or assistance, and with no prospect of ever getting back. Not ever. 36 hours, 30 minutes, 42 seconds. "Stand by," a technician said. "Coming in now." In the rubber floor, in the center of the curved water shields, small flashes of light appeared. Gordon glanced at Stern. "We'll know what happened in just a minute." The flashes grew brighter, and a machine began to emerge above the rubber. It was about 2 feet high when Gordon said, "God damn it, that guy is nothing but trouble." Stern said something, but Gordon paid no attention. He saw Barreto sitting there, propped up against a bar, clearly dead. The machine reached full size. He saw the pistols in his hand. He knew, of course, what had happened. Even though Kramer had specifically warned Barreto, the son of a bitch had taken modern weapons back with him. So, of course, Gomez sent him back and... A small dark object rolled out onto the floor. "What's that?" Stern said. "I don't know," Gordon said, staring at the screens. "It almost looks like a gr—" The explosion flashed in the transit room, blooming white on the video screens, washing everything out. Inside the control room, the sound was oddly distorted, more like a burst of static. The transit room was immediately filled with pale smoke. "Shit," Gordon said. He banged his fist down on the console. The technicians in the transit room were screaming. One man's face was covered with blood.
In the next moment, the man was swept off his feet in the rush of water as the shields collapsed, shattered by grenade fragments. Water 3 feet deep sloshed back and forth like surf, but almost immediately it began to drain out, leaving the newly bare floor hissing and steaming.
"It's the cells," Gordon said. "They've leaked hydrofluoric acid."
Obscured by smoke, figures in gas masks were running into the room, helping the injured technicians. Overhead beams began to crash down, shattering the remaining water shields. Other beams smashed down into the center of the floor. In the control room, someone gave a gas mask to Gordon and another to Stern. Gordon pulled his on.
"We have to go now," he said. "The air is contaminated."
Stern was staring at the screens. Through the smoke, he could see the other machines shattered, toppled over, leaking steam and pale green gas. There was only one still standing, off to one side, and as he watched, a connecting beam crashed down on it, crumpling it.
"There are no more machines," Stern said. "Does this mean..."
"Yes," Gordon said. "For now, I'm afraid your friends are on their own."
36 hours, 30 minutes.
"Just take it easy, Chris," Merrick said.
"Take it easy. Take it easy."
Chris was almost shouting. "Look at it, for Christ's sake, Andre. Her marker's trashed. We have no marker, which means we have no way to get home, which means we are totally screwed, Andre, and you want me to take it easy?"
"That's right, Chris," Merrick said, his voice very quiet, very steady. "That's what I want. I want you to take it easy, please. I want you to pull yourself together."
"Why the hell should I?" Chris said. "For what? Face the facts, Andre. We're all going to get killed here. You know that, don't you? We're going to get goddamn killed, and there is no way out of here."
"Yes, there is."
"I mean, we don't even have any food. We don't have goddamn anything, and we're stuck in this shithole without a goddamn paddle, and..."
He stopped and turned toward Merrick.
"What did you say?"
"I said there's a way out."
"How?"
"You're not thinking. The other machine has gone back to New Mexico."
"So?"
"They'll see his condition..."
"Dead, Andre. They'll see he's dead."
"The point is, they'll know something is wrong, and they will come for us. They'll send another machine to get us," Merrick said.
"How do you know?"
"Because they will." Merrick turned and started down the hill.
"Where are you going?"
"To find Kate. We have to keep together."
"I'm going to stay right here."
"As you like. Just as long as you don't leave."
"Don't worry. I'll be right here."
Chris pointed to the ground in front of him. "This is exactly where the machine arrived before, and that's where I'm staying." Merrick trotted off, disappearing around the curve in the path. Chris was alone. Almost immediately, he wondered if he ought to run and catch up with Merrick. Maybe it was better not to be alone. Stay together, as Merrick had said. He took a couple of steps down the path after Merrick, then stopped. No, he thought. He'd said he would stay where he was. He stood in the path, trying to slow his breathing. Looking down, he saw he was standing on Gomez's hand. He stepped quickly away. He walked a few yards back up the path, trying to find a spot where he could no longer see the body. His breathing slowed still more. He was able to think things over. Merrick was right, he decided. They would send another machine, and probably very soon. Would it land right here? Was this a known spot for landings? Or would it be somewhere in the general area? In either case, Chris felt certain he should stay exactly where he was. He looked down the path toward where Merrick had gone. Where was Kate now? Probably some distance down the path. A couple of 100 yards, maybe more. Jesus, he wanted to go home. Then, in the woods to his right, he heard a crashing sound. Someone was approaching. He tensed, aware that he had no weapon. Then he remembered his pack, which was tied to his belt beneath his clothes. He had that gas canister. It was better than nothing. He fumbled, lifting his overshirt, searching for the "sss." He turned. It was the teenage boy coming out of the woods. His face was smooth and beardless. He couldn't be more than 12, Chris realized. The boy whispered,
"Arketh, thou, earwash man."
Chris frowned, not understanding, but an instant later, he heard a tinny voice in his ear.
"Hey, you, Irisher."
The earpiece was translating, he realized.
What? He said. Kuman, hey, Steely.
In his ear he heard, come quickly. The boy was beckoning to him, tense, urgently, but,
come, Sir Guy will soon realize he has lost the trail. Then he will return to find it again. But, you cannot stay here. He will kill you. Come.
But, Chris gestured helplessly toward the path where Merrick had gone.
Your manservant will find you. Come.
Now he heard the distant rumble of horses' hooves, rapidly growing louder.
Are you dumb? The boy asked, staring at him. Come!
The rumble was closer. Chris stood frozen in place, not certain what to do. The boy lost patience. With a disgusted shake of his head, he turned and ran off through the forest. He immediately vanished in dense undergrowth. Chris stood alone on the trail. He looked down the path. He didn't see Merrick. He looked up the path toward the sound of the approaching horses. His heart was pounding again. He had to decide. Now.
I'm coming!
He shouted to the boy. Then he turned and ran into the woods. Kate sat on a fallen tree, touching her head gingerly, her wig askew. There was blood on her fingertips.
Are you hurt? Merrick said as he came up to her.
I don't think so.
Let me see.
Lifting the wig away, Merrick saw matted blood and a 3-inch gash across the scalp. The wound was no longer bleeding freely. The blood had begun to coagulate against the mesh of the wig. The injury deserved sutures, but she would be all right without them.
You'll survive.
He pushed the wig back down on her head. She said, what happened?
Those other two are dead. It's just us now. Chris is a little panicked.
Chris is a little panicked. She nodded, as if she had expected it.
Then we better go get him.
They started up the path.
As they walked, Kate said, what about the markers?
The guy went back and he took his. Gomez's body was trampled. Her marker was destroyed.
What about the other one? Kate said.
What other one?
She had a spare.
How do you know?
She said so. Don't you remember? When she came back from that reconnaissance trip, or whatever it was, she said that everything was fine and that we should hurry up and get ready. And she said, I'm going to go burn the spare, or something like that.
Merrick frowned.
It makes sense there would be a spare, Kate said.
Well, Chris will be glad to hear it, Merrick said.
They walked around the final curve, then they stopped and stared. Chris was gone. Plunging through the undergrowth, ignoring the brambles that scratched his legs and plucked at his hose, Chris Hughes at last glimpsed the boy running 50 yards ahead. But the boy did not heed him, did not stop, but continued to run forward. He was heading toward the village. Chris struggled to keep up. He kept running. Behind on the trail, he heard the horses rearing and snorting, and the shouts of the men. He heard one cry, "In the wood!" and another answered with a curse. But off the trail, the ground was densely covered. Chris had to scramble over fallen trees, rotting trunks, snapped branches as thick as his thigh, dense patches of bramble. Was this ground too difficult for horses? Would they dismount? Would they give up? Or would they chase?
Hell, they would chase.
He kept running. He was in a boggy area now. He pushed through the waist-high plants with their skunk-like smell, slipped in mud that grew deeper with each step. He heard the sound of his panting breath and the suck and slap of his feet in the mud. But he didn't hear anyone behind him. Soon the footing was dry again, and he was able to run faster. Now the boy was only 10 paces ahead of him, still going fast. Chris was panting, struggling to keep up, but he held his own. He ran on. There was a crackling in his left ear.
Chris.
It was Merrick.
Chris, where are you?
How did he answer? Was there a microphone? Then he remembered they'd said something about bone conduction. He said aloud,
I'm running.
I hear that. Where are you running?
The boy. The village.
You're going to the village?
I don't know. I think so.
You think so? Chris, where are you? And then behind him, Chris heard a crashing, the shouts of men, and the whinny of horses. The riders were coming after him, and he had left a trail of snapped branches and muddy footprints. It would be easy to follow.
Shit!
Chris ran harder, pushing himself to the limit, and suddenly he realized the young boy was no longer visible ahead. He stopped, gasping for breath, and spun around in a circle, looking. Gone. The boy had vanished. Chris was alone in the forest,
and the riders were coming. On the muddy path overlooking the monastery, Merrick and Kate stood listening to their earpieces. There was silence now. Kate clapped her hand over her ear to hear better. "I don't get anything."
"He may be out of range," Merrick said.
"Why is he going to the village? It sounds like he's following that boy," she said. "Why would he do that?"
Merrick looked toward the monastery. It was no more than a 10-minute walk from where they were standing. "The professor is probably down there right now. We could just go get him and go home." He kicked a tree stump irritably. "It would have been so easy."
"Not anymore," Kate said.
The sharp crack of static in their earpieces made them wince. They heard Chris panting again. Merrick said, "Chris, are you there?"
"I can't talk now."
He was whispering, and he sounded scared.
"No, no, no,"
the boy whispered, reaching down from the branches of a very large tree. He had whistled, finally taking pity on Chris as he spun in panicky circles on the ground below, and he had waved him to the tree. Chris was now struggling to climb the tree, trying to pull himself up on the lowest branches, getting extra leverage by bracing his legs against the trunk. But the way he did it upset the boy.
"No, no, hands. Use only the hands," the boy whispered, exasperated. "You are dumb. Look now, the marks on the trunk by your feet."
Hanging from a branch, Chris looked down. The boy was right. There were muddy streaks, very clear, on the bark of the trunk.
"By the rood, we are lost,"
the boy cried, swinging over Chris's head and dropping lightly to the ground.
"What are you doing?" Chris said.
But the boy was already running off, through the brambles, moving from tree to tree. Chris dropped back to the ground and followed. The boy muttered irritably to himself as he inspected the branches of each tree. Apparently, he wanted a very large tree with relatively low branches. None suited him. The sound of the riders was growing louder. Soon they had traveled 100 yards or more into an area carpeted with gnarled, scrubby ground pines. It was more exposed and sunnier here, because there were fewer trees to his right, and then Chris saw they were running near the edge of a cliff that overlooked the town and the river. The boy darted away from the sunlight back into the darker forest. Almost at once, he found a tree he liked and signaled Chris to come forward.
"You go first, and no feet."
The boy bent his knees, laced the fingers of his hands, and tensed his body, bracing himself. Chris felt the youth was too slender to take his weight, but the boy jerked his head impatiently. Chris put his foot in the boy's hands and, reaching upward, grasped the lowest branch. With the help of the boy, he pulled himself up until, with a final grunt, he swung himself over, so he lay on his stomach, bent double over the branch. He looked down at the boy, who hissed,
"Move!"
Chris struggled to his knees, then got to his feet on the branch. The next branch above was within easy reach, and he continued to climb up. Below, the boy leapt into the air, gripped the branch, and pulled quickly up. Although slim, he was surprisingly strong, and he moved from branch to branch surely. Chris was now about 20 feet above the ground. His arms burned. He was gasping as he went up, but he kept on going, branch to branch. The boy gripped his calf, and he froze. Slowly, cautiously, he looked back over his shoulder and saw the boy rigid on the branch beneath him. Then Chris heard the soft snort of a horse and realized the sound was close. Very close. On the ground below, 6 riders moved slowly and silently forward. They were still some distance away, intermittently visible through gaps in the foliage. When a horse snorted, its rider leaned forward to pat its neck to quiet it. The riders knew they were close to their prey. They leaned over in their saddles, scanning the ground, looking to one side and the other. Fortunately, they were now among the scrubby low pines. No trail was visible. Communicating by hand gestures, they moved apart, separating themselves as they came forward. Now they formed a rough line, passing beneath the tree on both sides. Chris held his breath.
If they looked up.
But they didn't. They moved onward, deeper into the forest, and finally one of them spoke aloud. It was the rider, with a black plume on his helmet, the one who cut off Gomez's head. His visor was up.
"Here is enough.
They have slipped us.
How? Over the cliff?
The Black Knight shook his head.
The child is not so foolish.
Chris saw his face was dark. Dark complexion and dark eyes.
Nor quite a child, my lord. If he fell, it was by error. It could not be otherwise. But I